You can listen to Issues Etc. live and on demand with the new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. You can get these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Give us a call, send us an email, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. The new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. Download today at issuesetc.org. There's an app for that. We were all taught the history in probably junior high through high school, the history of the Second World War, of the Nazi aggression in Europe. And the story sometimes just ends when the war is over. The war is over. The Allies won. Ticker tape parade. A sailor kissing a military nurse in Times Square. And that's the end of the history. But of course, the story didn't end there. There were war trials, the Nuremberg trials, and that story is less told. And one of the least told stories is of a man who stood, who probably was central to the lives of the dozens of Nazis who were on trial at the Nuremberg trial. He was their chaplain. He was also a Lutheran chaplain, an army chaplain, Henry Gericke. Joining us to tell the story of this army chaplain at the trial of the Nazis, Tim Townsend, former religion reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, senior writer and editor of the Pew Research Center's Religion and Public Life Project in Washington, D.C., and he's authored the new book, Mission at Nuremberg. Tim, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
The war history is well known. Most people learn that in grade school or junior high, but the post-war history, in particular these trials that you call a judicial improvisation, that's not so well known. Tell us that history in a nutshell.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually, because we sort of, a lot of people just kind of stop when it comes to VE Day, you know, as soon as Hitler killed himself in his bunker and the Allies were victorious. You know, a lot of us kind of then move on to the next piece of history. But you're right, there was the aftermath, of course, and the Allies wanted to hold the Nazis to account. And so the planning for that actually happened quite a long time before the war's end, with a lot of the major Allied leaders weighing in. Churchill actually favored just sort of summary executions. You find a Nazi in a field somewhere, if he's a big enough deal, you figure out who he is, you have him state his name, and then you shoot him. And Roosevelt actually at first was okay with that, until some of his attorneys said, "Mr. President, you have to give some credence to the idea of a trial, if only so that these men can answer for what they've just done." And so all the Allied leaders got together and decided that one judge from each of the Allied countries would sit in judgment of as many of the leaders as they could round up, or whoever they decided to put on trial. And those men essentially represented the Third Reich. And in the end, there were 21 of them who were on trial in Nuremberg between November of 1945 and October of 1946.
The nature of their crimes, just so we understand, because in many ways, none of the countries had laws. The world didn't have laws to fit the nature of the crimes that had been committed. How would you describe it?
That's right. And what happened when they were when the architects of the Nuremberg trials were attempting to come up with a way to a legal means and to put these men on trial to judge them, they did have to experiment. And in the way that they finally decided to do it was to try most of these men on four counts of varying descriptions. The most familiar to us now is crimes against humanity and war crimes. And the way that they put this together was to argue, the prosecutors argued, that this was a massive conspiracy, so that not only these 21 men were on trial for their crimes, but also the apparatus of the Third Reich was also on trial. So the organizations, the Gestapo, the SD, the SS. Each of those entities also was on trial during the Nuremberg trials, which is why when you hear somebody say the Nuremberg trials, it's a plural, because there were so many different moving parts.
How did Chaplain Henry Gericke, how did he come to be assigned as the chaplain to these men who stood on trial as the proxies in some ways? They were guilty of their own crimes, but as proxies for all of the Nazi regime.
Yeah, he was really in the right place at the right time from his point of view. He was a pastor in St. Louis. That was for most of his career at a church in South St. Louis. During the Depression, he decided that he wanted to be a missioner, and so became the executive missioner of the St. Louis Lutheran City Mission. And he ministered to people during the Depression, people on the streets, people in prison, in the jails, in the St. Louis City jails, in the hospitals, and insane asylums. Two of his sons, eventually, when the war began, went off to war. And in 1943, right before his 50th birthday, he decided he too wanted to go to war, and he volunteered to be a chaplain. And that was how he got there. He became a hospital chaplain in the 98th General Hospital, which was a transit hospital about 60 miles west of London. He was a chaplain for the doctors and nurses there, but also for the wounded men who were being flown in from the front lines to really just be stitched up and held together in this transit hospital before they could be then moved to a more permanent hospital in London.
Did he want the assignment?
Well, he didn't know. That hospital, after the war, moved down into Germany and wound up in Munich, and that's where the Nuremberg organizers heard about him. They needed chaplains because of the Geneva Convention statute that says all prisoners of war have to be offered a chaplain. Typically, that was done by naming one of the captured who was ordained as the chaplain. In this case, it was Nuremberg. It was the Nuremberg trials, and security was such that they didn't trust a German chaplain to do the job. And so they heard that Gericke was nearby in Munich, that he spoke German from his Cape Girardeau roots. He was a Lutheran, which most of the Nazis were, and he had that experience in the St. Louis City jails. So he was offered the job, and really it was an offer. He was given the opportunity by his commanding officer in the hospital to turn it down. He prayed about it. He talked to his son, Hank, who was in Europe at the time, and eventually decided that what he wanted to do was to take the assignment and to try to save as many of these souls as he could before the men were executed at Nuremberg.
You point out that he was, in fact, the very first chaplain to serve the vanquished enemy, so to speak.
Right. The part of the book goes through the history of military chaplaincy from the times of the Egyptians forward. And in all of that time, it was very rare for anybody of any enemy to minister to the enemy in any sustained way. There were instances of praying with the enemy, but there was nothing like this that had ever been done before. And so Gericke and his assistant chaplain, Father Sixtus O'Connor, who was a Franciscan friar from New York State, took this job on as the first in history to do it.
What was the assignment? You mentioned the Geneva Conventions, but what was he assigned to actually do among the Nazis there in Nuremberg?
Well, his boss, the commandant of the prison, Colonel Burton Andrus, was a pragmatist, and he believed that aside from ticking off the box of following the Geneva Conventions, having chaplains there would be good for the morale of the 21 prisoners. He had already had a couple of suicides on his watch and didn't want any more. And so he believed that at least the appearance of some sort of spiritual comfort or spiritual opportunity and discussion would maintain some morale among the Nazi prisoners, who, after all, were about to go in front of the world's cameras to try to answer for the crimes that they had committed. And so these two men were asked to really, I think, just be a listening ear and serve some kind of to hold services, to pray with these men. They were certainly not given instruction by the U.S. government to try to win souls, and that was something that they took on based on their own calling and ministry.
And Garrickey and his assistant certainly could have just kind of given the appearance of spiritual counsel to these Nazis, and probably no one in Nuremberg would have blamed them for just going through the motions. But Garrickey did far more than going through the motions, didn't he?
He did, and I think that's why he took the job in the first place. He realized that if he was going to do this, he did it for the reasons that his church would have instructed him to do. As a pastor, he hadn't seen his wife in almost 2.5 years at that point, or his youngest son. He desperately, like all people at the end of the war, wanted to go home. But he was presented with this opportunity and decided that as a minister and as a Christian pastor, he really couldn't turn it down. That these were, in the most dramatic way, the worst of the worst. And in order to live up to his Christian faith and his particular job as a Christian and as a pastor, he needed to stay and he needed to try and win these souls back for Christ.
Tim Townsend is our guest. We're talking about Henry Garrickey, a Lutheran Army chaplain at the Nuremberg trial. Stay tuned.
Listen to What You Want, When You Want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Folks attending last year's Making the Case conference absolutely loved the barbecue from Randy's House of Barbecue in Troy and Highland, Illinois. The pork, chicken, ribs, and beef are prepared just like the old days in a pit cooked over hickory, apple, and wild cherry wood. Randy's House of Barbecue, Route 40 and Troy O'Fallon Road in Troy, and at 2649 Northtown Way in Highland. Randy's House of Barbecue, randysbbq.com.
What is God's purpose for marriage? How should we respond when traditional marriage is openly mocked as irrelevant? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March is titled Your Marriage by God's Design. It's written by Issues Etc. regular guests Scott and Julie Stiegemeyer. You can find out more about Your Marriage by God's Design at issuesetc.org, or you can call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Your Marriage by God's Design, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Thursday afternoon, March the 20th, we're talking with Tim Townsend, author of the new book, Mission at Nuremberg, telling the story about a Lutheran Army chaplain, Henry Garrickey, and his ministry to the Nazis who are on trial in the Nuremberg trials. Tim, before the break, you mentioned that he really did see himself as having a mission there among those Nazis, among those war criminals, to bring them salvation. In your opinion, was Chaplain Garrickey successful in that?
He believed that he was. There were 21 Nazis. I believe there were about 5 or 6 of them were either professed or nominally Catholic, and the rest were either professed or nominally Protestant and Lutheran, because of that was Protestant in Germany at the time. And so, some of those in each of their camps, people like Julius Streicher and Alfred Rosenberg and Rudolf Hess, refused any sort of spiritual counsel. So each of them had a handful of members of their certain flocks, but both chaplains believed that by the time of the executions, they had each brought several of those groups back to Christianity.
Goering was the highest-ranking prisoner there, and is an interesting story that you tell about him and Henry Garrickey, because while he was, you know, affable and cordial and in many ways cooperative with the chaplain's efforts, he was also adamantly, although he regarded himself in some sense as a
member of the church, he was adamantly against the teachings that Garrickey brought.
Yeah, and I think that was one of Garrickey's biggest challenges during that year, was to attempt to bring the big man, as he called him, as he called Goring, back to the church in a way that he realized, or that he would have acknowledged, Garrickey would have acknowledged, was real. Goring, like Rosenberg, considered himself Gottglaubig. He believed in God, but not Christ. And this was common among the Nazis. And through the year, he would participate in every worship service in a cell that Garrickey and O'Connor built by knocking down a wall in a cell and created a chapel. He would participate loudly in the hymns, more loudly than anyone else. And yet, by the end, Garrickey still did not believe that he had really believed in the Christian message. And on the last night, of right before the executions, Garrickey was still trying with Goring, went to his cell and gave it a final shot. And as you mentioned, Goring ridiculed the Trinity and the entire history of the church. And Garrickey was about to leave, sort of disheartened that he had failed, when Goring asked him for communion, to give him the Lord's Supper. And Garrickey went through and described what he was asking for, and said, I can't just give you the Lord's Supper. You profess not to believe in the tenets of the Christian faith." And Garrickey believed that Goring was simply looking for an insurance policy. He knew he was about to die, and he wanted to just in case this Christianity thing was true, he wanted a final shot at the sacrament, and Garrickey refused.
Tell the story of Goring's suicide, because it does highlight the degree to which, to the very last second, Chaplain Garrickey was extending the mercy of God to this man, was in many ways even cajoling him to believe in Jesus Christ.
Right. In the end, in the scene I was just describing, he went as far as using Goring's wife and child, saying to Goring, "Your daughter wants to meet you in heaven." Garrickey had a relationship with a lot of the families of the Nazis and tried to comfort them as well as the Nazis themselves. And so he knew Edda and Emma and Emmy Goring well, and had conversations about Christianity with Goring's little girl, and said to him on that last night, "This is the only way that you'll be able to see your daughter again in heaven." And still, Goring refused. And so he tried in a lot of different ways. And just hours later, as Garrickey and O'Connor were listening to the World Series, actually getting updates on the score of the Cardinals Red Sox game in the World Series from the guard booth, a guard yelled out that something was wrong with Goring, and Garrickey was the first one there at his side after he had taken potassium cyanide, and watched him breathe his last breaths and prayed over him as he did.
So let's talk a bit about the men to whom he ministered, and then I like to talk about really kind of the grisly story of their executions. It's simply, you know, the history to tell.
Sure.
Did some of these men remain, I think you know what I mean when I ask, did they remain Nazis to the end?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think a good number of them, possibly even including Goring, were much more loyal to Hitler and the idea of Hitler and the Third Reich, even throughout the trials, even in private, not just in the bluster of the courtroom, but many of them to the end were still giving the Hitler salute. Julius Streicher, Rudolf Hess, many of them were doubling down on Nazism, even as they were on trial, for embracing it to such an extent that they had been part of the architects of a genocide in the name of the Third Reich.
And the men whom Gericke and his assistant were able to reach, those who realized the magnitude of their crimes, how would you describe them?
Well, the way that Gericke described them was penitent. I think we'll never know exactly what happened in the confessional in any of these cases. Gericke and O'Connor both took that incredibly seriously. Later in life, Gericke would never talk to even his sons about what happened in the confessional. So we actually will never know. But he did describe, Gericke did describe in his own writings some of the way in which the handful, and by handful I mean I think seven of the Nazis, four of whom were executed, came back to the church, and he describes that as a joyful occasion for him. And Father O'Connor, in the same way, believed that a couple of his charges were converted back to the Catholic faith.
Let's talk about the executions. I think the decided upon manner of execution for those who would receive the death sentence at Nuremberg was death by hanging. You tell poignant stories about how the prisoners are hearing the gallows being constructed there and kind of realize the time was coming. A couple questions in that regard. Gericke was hesitant to share with his Nazi charges the time or the dating of the executions after the sentencing. Why was that?
Orders. That was the simple reason, was orders. He was told, he and O'Connor were told the morning of the executions that they would be happening that night. He did not know before that, and was told by Colonel Andrus, their commandant, not to say anything. And in the entire day that came next, these chaplains knew what was coming, were going around cell to cell offering prayers and counsel. And despite the fact that for the last 2 weeks since the sentencing there was a flurry of activity in this regard, it was ramped up on this day. And so even if they weren't allowed by the army to say anything specifically or answer questions, many of which they got from the prisoners, the prisoners could tell by their activity and their desperate need to kneel with them and pray that they knew what was coming in the hours ahead.
Now, some of the Nazi officers thought that hanging was they were asking through their attorneys for a different manner of execution. What was going on there?
Right, a lot of the Nazis, especially the military prisoners like Alfred Jodl and Wilhelm Keitel, they were soldiers, and they believed that the honorable way to die would be to be shot. Goering was especially afraid of hanging. They knew stories. They had hanged people. They had watched it happen, so they knew what a horrible death that could be. And many of them petitioned the judges to be shot instead. It was also seen as a sort of a poor way to die. Hanging doesn't have the honor of being executed by shooting does. And so all of that was denied eventually, and hanging was exactly what took place.
Tim Townsend is our guest. He's a former religion reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, senior writer and editor of the Pew Research Center's Religion and Public Life Project in Washington, D.C., and he's authored the new book, Mission at Nuremberg, subtitled An American Army Chaplain and the Trials of the Nazis. We'll be right back.
Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+. Simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen On Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
Do you have a student finishing up 8th grade at a Lutheran school? Do you wish there were a Lutheran high school close to where you live so your student could continue going to a Lutheran school? What if there was an opportunity for high school students in public or Lutheran school to take classes like Latin, logic, and hard-hitting theology courses? Well, there is. It's called Wittenberg Academy, the first completely online classical Lutheran high school. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Where do we find Jesus in the book of Job? I've written an article in the latest Issues Etc. journal titled Job in 4 Not-So-Easy Steps. You can read it by subscribing to the online Issues Etc. journal. Just look for the red subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. Pastor Ross Johnson has written our Wittenberg Trail feature. It's titled Lutheranism, Christianity's Best Kept Secret, the free online Issues Etc. journal.
In Higher Things, we believe that if you put good Christ crucified for you Lutheranism into a youth, you'll get a good Christ crucified for you Lutheran youth. Join us this July at the Higher Things Crucified Youth Conferences in Florida, Wisconsin, Utah. Check us out at www.higherthings.org. Higherthings.org. Dare your youth to be Lutherans this summer.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about the story of a Lutheran Army chaplain, Chaplain Henry Gericke, and the trial of the Nazis at Nuremberg. Tim Townsend is our guest. We kind of have come here, Tim, to the foot of the gallows, so to speak, that you spoke about before the break. And one of the duties that Chaplain Gericke and his assistant chaplain had was to accompany those condemned men to those gallows. Tell us that story.
Yeah, it's a dramatic story because we know a lot about it because Gericke wrote about it. In the hours after Göring's suicide, the security was heightened. The prisoners were woken up, told to get ready. They were now handcuffed to a guard so that they couldn't also commit suicide, given a last supper of black bread and some noodles. Many of them didn't eat that. A lot of the military men who were condemned cleaned their cells and made sure that everything was nice and straight in that hour. And then one by one, their sentence was read again to them aloud by the commandant, and they were marched from the prison with the chaplains following into the gymnasium where the gallows had been constructed the night before. And in front of the press and the four judges of the tribunal, each of them was asked his name and then walked up the 13 steps to the top of the gallows. Often there, those who did want to participate in some sort of prayer did with one of the chaplains, and a black hood was placed over their head, and they went through the trap door.
So Gericke witnessed all of these executions.
He did. He and O'Connor were there for all of them. Toward the end, they were both exhausted. Gericke described O'Connor as almost fainting at one point because of the sort of mental exhaustion of it all. And then the two of them, at the end, when all the Nazis were hanged, went back together to witness the bodies that were laid out on the gym floor and said prayers over them and gave them whatever last rites and benedictions they thought were necessary.
It was one of the things that he didn't speak about explicitly, but Gericke did describe that in some ways the hangings were a little botched. The gallows were poorly constructed, and you know, his reflection on it seems to have been that they could have done a better job. What was going on there?
Right. The hangman was an army hangman. He had done a lot of these before, and it has been told since then in a book by one of the men who was in charge of the hangings, named Tillis. He wrote a lot about how this hangman, intentionally botched some of the hangings. So Julius Streicher, for instance, he made sure that there was not enough rope, or too much rope, sorry, so that on the way down they would, you know, break their noses on the trapdoor. Gehrke didn't say that explicitly, but said that when he and Chaplain O'Connor went around the corner to look at the bodies, he said it was a story that could never be told. So I think it was a pretty grisly scene in the aftermath of the executions.
Did Gehrke ever reflect upon kind of the notions of that it had to have been something of a little, at least a tension in the minds of some, that these are men that he was desperately trying to save for eternal life, but he was also a participant in the system at Nuremberg that would see to it that they answered for their crimes with their lives. Did he ever reflect upon that kind of dual justice?
Well, he knew, you know, he knew that these men were being judged by man in the courtroom, that there was a, you know, that this had to take place. This has been a world war. He knew he had been to Dachau. O'Connor had liberated with the 11th Armored Division, had liberated Mauthausen concentration camp in Austria, had buried thousands of bodies in the aftermath, the immediate aftermath of the war, before going to Nuremberg. So they both had their eyes wide open about what these men had been responsible for. But as you say, they believed that they were Christian ministers, and they believed that these men, despite what they had done on earth, had been forgiven already. And so their job was to try to instill some sort of transformation from the darkness of Hitler's Germany back into what they believed was the light of the church and of Christianity.
After the trials and the executions, what became of Henry Gehrke?
He had an amazing story even after this amazing story. He came back to the U.S., was in the reserves, and was a chaplain at a disciplinary barracks for the Army in Milwaukee for a little bit, and then essentially in retirement moved to Chester, Illinois, became a pastor of a church there called St. John's, assistant pastor of a church there, and his day-to-day job was as a chaplain at the Menard Correctional Facility, the maximum security prison in Chester, as their chaplain. And so he, again, was drawn to evil. He ministered to murderers and all the rest of that kind of whoever's in the maximum security prison. Henry Gehrke was your chaplain. And, in fact, I'm going to be in Chester on Saturday with Hank Gehrke, who's Henry Gehrke's eldest son, to do a talk at the Chester Public Library.
Gehrke kind of did a bit of a speaking circuit after he returned. What was the nature of this? How did he tell his story? You call it the DeSoto speech, but how did he tell his story?
Well, he told his story in a way that was that had a lesson in it. He wanted people to know. He knew it was a good story. He was a good storyteller. He was an excellent preacher. He knew how to get people's attention. He had a great voice for it. In fact, had his own radio show a couple times in his life. And, told the story of meeting the Nazis for the first time and of some of his interactions with them, including with Göring, and of escorting them to the gallows. But always at the end of it, there was a lesson of Christian faith and of inspiration, that despite the horrors of what these men did, they were not beyond the light of Christ as he tried to bring it to them.
Why has it taken so long to tell the story of this man who really was, in a lot of ways, central to the last days of this little regiment of Nazis that answered for the crimes of the entire Reich?
Well, it's interesting. What I found out I was looking through the papers at the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. They have a collection of Burton Andrus's papers, Gehrke's boss at Nuremberg. And I found a letter that Andrus had written to his own wife talking about this terrible thing that had happened to Chaplain Gehrke when he left Nuremberg on his way back to the States. He had taken a train to Frankfurt to see his son who'd been wounded and he was at a hospital there. And when he got off the train, his suitcase was stolen by some kids. And eventually, some military police found the suitcase, but it was empty. It was open in the rail yard, and everything in it except a pair of gloves that Goring had given him was gone. And it turns out that what was in that suitcase were his notes. He had been hoping to maybe write his own book about his experience, but for some reason that wasn't meant to be, and he never got to write the book. O'Connor didn't talk about his experience almost at all when he got home. And so I don't know. I think as a journalist, I got lucky by finding my way to the story and having some time and some great sources, including his son Hank, who gave me a lot of great detail about his parents in order to write the book.
Tim Townsend is a former religion reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, senior writer and editor of the Pew Research Center's Religion and Public Life Project in Washington, D.C., and he's author of the new book, Mission at Nuremberg. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Tim, thank you very much.
Thank you, Todd, for having me. It was a pleasure.
Folks, if you appreciate informative interviews like this, please consider making a tax-deductible gift to support Issues Etc. Talk Radio for the Thinking Christian. No contribution is too small. Remember that. You can donate by check, make your check payable to Issues Etc., and send it to Issues Etc., Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. The address again, Issues Etc., Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also make a secure online gift at issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support. When we come back, Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer will be our guest. We're going to find Christ in the Old Testament. In fact, right there in Exodus chapter 17. Stay tuned.
Check out the updated showroom at Valo Floor Coverings, 1009 Plummer Drive in Edwardsville. Valo's offers free in-home measurement, interior design consultation, and experienced installation. Celebrating 50 years of trusted experience, Valo Floor Coverings, 1009 Plummer Drive in Edwardsville, 618-656-7788 or valofloor.com.
Have you wondered what classical Lutheran education is all about? Are you a Lutheran homeschooler, pastor, or teacher? Would you like to be equipped to teach more effectively? Join the Consortium for Classical and Lutheran Education July 15th through the 17th at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Find the conference schedule recently posted at ccle.org. Discover the education that is our Lutheran heritage, ccle.org.
Hey, St. Louis, how would you like to achieve your fitness goals in a fun and supportive atmosphere? Hi, this is Kevin Reisick, owner and operator of Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois. We offer adult boot camps throughout the week. These camps include cardiovascular conditioning, muscular strength and endurance training, balance and coordination activities, and more. For more information, give me a call at 618-670-6952, Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois, 618-670-6952.
At Redeemer Lutheran Church in Fort Wayne, we are mostly looked down upon by cool people. They're always telling us that we take ourselves too seriously. That, apparently, is the uncoolest thing on the planet. We are theological nerds. We get more incensed by bad exegesis than a group of comic book fans who find out the hero was just dreaming. Some people want us to calm down, but we aren't going to. Redeemer, Fort Wayne, haven for theological nerds.
Often imitated, never equaled. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things, the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us, broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifest the love of Christ in our love for one another, and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155.